Tonight, Mike has an identity crisis. James likes his wood right. And we tell the grammar Nazis to fuck off.
Hey, this is James from StrawPunk.com.
And this is Couch Potato Mike. How are you doing this week, sir?
Lovely. That's a wonderful southern accent you have there. A very sweet southern accent.
Oh, yeah. It's very, very southern. You can really tell I'm from the heartland.
Heartland. Yeah, you girl.
Yeah, I'm a really girly southern guy, don't you know?
Yeah. Oh, my God. How have you been this week?
Well, I've been doing okay, you know, just putting around the house, hanging with yous guys and all that stuff. Just trying to survive the best way a good old southern boy can, you know.
Trying to be your very best Tennessee nice.
Yep. Gotta be, you know, it's the Tennessee nice thing to do.
Tennessee nice thing to do. As soon as we get this podcast knocked out, I'm going to go build an herb spiral for those of you that are not into permaculture. No, you don't have to build a fucking herb spiral. I think they're fucking cool. I'm going to build one, so suck it. So you build a 5 foot wide, 2 foot tall, mound of dirt, put rocks around it and make a spiral out of it. Cause you, by building a spiral and building it vertically, you get to put more herbs in that 5 foot space than you could if you made a 5 foot, like, raised bed garden.
That's pretty ingenious, and it keeps them from intermingling in a way that you don't want them to, because it's kind of spiraling up like one of those old staircases.
Yeah, and you can put the ones that like sun the most on the south side, the ones that like sun the least on the northern side.
Oh, yeah. I can see how that would be beneficial to everything growing there.
The ones that like water the most, you put on the bottom, because water will trickle down. The ones that like water the least, you put on the top. So, herb spiral's pretty neat, and I think it'll make the front of my house where I'm going to put it look pretty good.
Now, you did say the ones that like water the least you put on the top, eh?
Bottom.
Bottom?
Bottom.
Well, it seems like all the water would wind up collecting down there.
Yes. That's why you put the ones that like the water the most at the bottom.
That's what I just said, the least.
The ones that like the water the most you put on the bottom.
I know, but I asked about the least.
The ones you put on the least you put on the top.
Well, that's what I said. Money bread. Don't
whatever.
You know?
Yeah, so, but that
you
way...
You guys, please drop us an email at james@survivalpunk.com and let me know if I'm the only one that's hearing him, you know, screw up the English language and whatnot.
No, the ones that like the water the most, you put it at the top. The ones that like the water the most, you put it at the bottom. The ones that like the water the least, you put it at the top.
Okay, that makes sense. That makes a lot more sense than... Yeah, and before we continue on, I'd just like to give a shout-out to my good buddy, Jeff Radke. And I just want to let you know, it's okay to be gay, man. I mean, I know the closets run deep up there in Minnesota, but it'll be all right. It'll be all right. You can just come out, be like, I'm here, I'm queer, and get used to it.
You do know he lives in Wisconsin. Not Minnesota.
They're all the same. It's pretty much the same state. They can't even tell which state they're in half the time.
The twin states?
Yeah, the twin states, Wisconsin. And they just need to call it Wisconsin-Soda. Yeah. Or some crazy crap. You know, it don't matter. All they do
I pretty much call everything, like, above Kentucky, not the South.
Yeah, pretty, well, everything above Kentucky is not the South. Technically,
just one state, like, not the South.
Oh, not the South?
Yeah.
You know, Kentucky was actually part of the North during the Civil War,
doesn't make no sense.
Oh, yeah, don't you know? Yeah, it was all way up there. Those guys up there, yeah, they were all Yankees.
Them guys are gay.
Well, all they got to do is, you know, drink beer and eat cheese.
Yeah. Awesome. What do we got coming up today?
Well, coming up today...
Couch Potato Cheese Wheel.
Yes. This is Cheese Wheel Mike today. Coming up today on the show, we're going to be talking about how some hippies build their own island, about how a guy shoots some home intruders and is now facing charges because of it. We're going to give you a story about true survival, and we're going to be reviewing some Primal Mayo. But before we get into that, we need to tell you about the good people over at Mai Tai Exotic Asian Coffee, don't you know?
Yes. How I wish this very morning I was drinking a cup of Mai Tai coffee. But I am not. But that's no reason for you not to be drinking Mai Tai Exotic Asian Coffee, because they are the best coffee I've ever drunked in my life.
I think it's drank, actually.
Drunked? I drunked it my belly.
What do they do up in Wisconsin? Do they get drunked? I think they do.
They do. They get drunked off of beer and bratwurst.
Beer and bratwurst.
Mmm, gotta have them the bratwurst.
That sounds pretty good. That sounds pretty good, actually. Beer and bratwurst.
But my Thai exotic Asian coffee tastes better than beer and bratwurst.
Oh, of course it does. And beer and bratwurst, you know, it doesn't help out a local orphanage.
No. My Thai exotic Asian coffee does help out a local local charity where a portion of the proceeds go to this local charity where they provide homes for these orphans, schooling for these orphans.
Medical all their attention. Medical needs.
What is it? Is home, school, medical? Something else.
Dental?
I don't know.
I don't know either.
Home, school, medical.
What they help out these. They help out poor kids that don't got parents.
Food. They give them food.
Oh, yeah, they give them food.
And the people that work the Mai Tai Exotic Asian Coffee Trees get paid a fair wage to support their family.
They can afford to live over there.
Instead of a slave labor wage, like Folgers pays their bitches.
Oh, yeah. Folgers pays them slave wages. That's just horrible, you know.
Yep. Don't you know?
Don't you know it?
Ah.
But that's, find the banner on the right-hand side of survivalpunk.com for Mai Tai Exotic Asian Coffee.
Click it. Click it so hard.
All right, now, let's just jump right... Double-click it. Click the hell out of it.
I'm excited my DVR set to record the Woodwright Shop today at 4:30 in the afternoon.
Oh, the Woodwright Shop.
Central Standard Time.
Well, that's like my favorite show.
Yeah.
I've never heard of it.
I still... And you're tired of this joke. I haven't told it in a while. And Gabriel was sick of hearing me say it. But there was one time in the Woodwright Shop with, what was his name? Underhill. Roy Underhill in the Woodwright Shop. Which I remember from my youth, like, he would work on projects only with, like, old hand tools and stuff. Nothing modern.
Oh, yeah, I actually have seen that.
And he got injured all the time. Like, he was bleeding on every wood project ever as a kid. He's like, oh, I lopped my finger off. Oh, that shit happens, man. He was going to this episode one time, like, recently. Like, his episodes are on, like, I think PBS.org or whatever their website is. You can watch, like, a lot of the newer episodes for free. So he's going through an episode recently on planes. Wood planes.
Right.
And there's like, a billion different kinds of planes. Like, there's planes that would do, like, crown molding. Like, it's made to cut, like, those, like, circle, you know, like router bits kind of
thing. Oh,
yeah,
I know exactly what you're talking about.
There's apparently a plane called a Badger plane, and he was planing shit away, and he's like,
Badger.
No. He's like, you can just plane away with the Badger plane, because Badger plane don't give a heck. Badger plane don't give a damn. Oh, my God. Everyone in the audience is like facepalm right now. They're like, God damn it, James. Badger you plane fucking lost us. But if you have a Badger plane and you want to send it to jamesfrogpunk.com, email me and I'll give you my address and you can mail me a Badger plane so I can fucking plane shit like I don't give a damn.
Yeah, we'll dedicate it to you on the show, you know.
Yep.
Get that dedication right over there to you.
Frogpunk don't give a damn.
Frogpunk don't give no heck. Anyway, we're going to jump right into our news story here about how some hippies build an island.
I'm so jealous of these motherfuckers.
Oh, yeah. Are you going to bring that up there? Because, I can't read that.
Oh, are we going into the news right now?
Yeah, you told me that we're skipping this one this week.
Yeah.
For, you know, time.
Did you mention what we're talking about today?
Yeah, I already did all that.
God, that's when I block you out and not listen
to
you.
Where the hell were you? You make me feel so ineffectual, you son of a bitch.
This one.
And... not that one. That's our main topic.
No, not this one. This comes from our friends at MindBodyGreen.com.
This couple has spent decades building their own self-sustaining island, don't you know?
Talk about extreme green. Artists Wayne Adams and Catherine King spent their days completely immersed in nature. This Cantonadian couple lives off the grid on a floating, sustainable island appropriately named Freedom Cove.
I saw what you did there.
Yeah. King and Adams say that the cove, cast on Cypress Bay in Tofino, British Columbia, we're just talking about British Columbia, has allowed them to interact with nature without interfering with it. Hippies, their eco-paradise features greenhouses, an art gallery, and a lighthouse tower, all of which are fashioned from recycled materials and painted in bright shades of pink and purple.
Oh my God, you just lost me there.
Yeah, I know. The couple grows their own food on expensive gardens that weave throughout the property and harness energy from an array of solar panels.
We live our lives in a manner that we hope adds to the health of the environment, explains King. We do our best to live conscientiously this way every day. Freedom Cove is an escape more than 20 years in the making, and it's not finished yet. Wayne and Catherine continue to brainstorm new pieces to add to their already spectacular puzzle. Check out the photo archive to see the island, see how the island became the place it is today. Warning, prepare for a jaw drop.
Yes, and you will see
there's
the
a bunch
photos.
Of pictures there. I can't read pictures.
I mean, it started out looking, you know, just like...
Looked like driftwood.
Yeah, and then now it's actually...
It looks like a trailer park got flooded.
Kinda.
It does.
With green stuff growing and...
I know, it's pretty sweet, actually. I wouldn't mind staying a night or two over there, don't you know?
Yeah. Have you ever wondered what happened to,
It looks like a giant dildo.
The giant city from, It does not look like a giant dildo.
That looked like a giant spirally...
They made a totem pole of, like... Spirally
something. I've seen something like that in Hustler Hollywood.
The floating island they used in Waterworld. Did they dismantle that? Like, I think they just left it there. I like to like fuck it and just left it sitting there.
They may have just left it there, you know.
I'm pretty sure they did.
You know, they still have a Waterworld attraction at one of the theme parks. It's a live show. Not really an attraction you can walk through, but they have a live Waterworld show. It's been running for years now. I mean, decades. People love it.
It's weird.
Actually, I think it may have gotten recently replaced by the Batman show.
Oh, I'd much rather see that.
Oh, that happens.
Yeah.
You know, at the time, Waterworld was the most expensive movie ever made.
I did know that. Until, I think, Terminator 2 that overtook it.
No, actually, it overtook Terminator 2.
Anyway. So, I keep finding these articles about people that are basically like, okay, so, fuck you. Yep. We're just going to go make our own thing.
Yeah, fuck the system.
Yeah, we don't need
system.
You.
Our system is better.
Yeah. So that I just where I see the revolution going. Like that's like when people are like, "Oh, I'm pissed off about this. Let me go protest, or let me go vote and do my civic duty to vote." Blah blah blah. Go make a damn island.
Yeah.
That's how you fight the system. Make a fucking island.
I mean, these two people, they went out there and made their own damn island out of found materials from a lot of it looks like, and they built it up.
Yeah.
I mean, they're growing shit on it. They built a fucking island, you know.
They built a fucking island.
They built a fucking island.
Yeah. I mean, you know what? I may make this a series. I may make this a series of people that have said fuck you and then built their own society.
Damn the man, we'll create our own empire.
We make that a whole show topic.
That would be awesome. Yeah, we need to do that. We need to look that up. But coming up next on the show...
I'm not done talking about this yet.
I can still tell you what's coming up next.
No, you can't. You shut your fucking pie hole.
You shut your fucking pie hole.
Cheese wheel Mike.
Cheesy potato Mike.
Cheesy potato Mike.
Yeah, that works out better. That'd
cheesy potato.
Great, now I'm hungry.
Now you're hungry. You should have ate before we podcasted.
You should eat my balls while we podcast.
I had a terrible thought, and then if we have any liberals that are listening to the show...
What the hell are you doing on this show?
They may. I mean, we talk about some...
Liberals and conservatives alike. They're all stupid.
I was like, if you're a liberal, I believe you should bust your ass at your job, maybe even get a second job, and then bust your ass and get promoted at both your jobs, so that you can then make more money, so that you can then move to a higher tax bracket, so you can then support the government through your taxes that you want the government to have taken from people, so the government can then take the taxes that they steal from people that would be voluntarily for you, because you're voluntarily giving the government your taxes, more of them, by working harder and being more productive to be taxed harder, to then give to people that do not want to work. So that's my thing. If you're a Democrat or a liberal, I believe that you need to work harder so the government can tax you more and you fully support the government that you fully support.
Yeah, that way, you know, those out there that can work but don't want to, they can get their welfare and their food stamps and their unemployment and disabilities and all that stuff. Yeah.
I wrote an article.
Disability checks for being mental, that just irritates the shit out of me.
I always thought, like, instead of just getting money for having a disability, the governments would be like, okay, and obviously I'm an anarchist, so I'm not a big fan of that at all. Another point. I'm just gonna go off on a rant. Like, I got.
What
so
do you
many...
mean going to? You're already on the rant. You're 3 miles down the rant.
One of the things I think about is the people I know that are the most liberal. I have never heard them talk about or seen them give money to a charity.
Why would they do that? They need their money.
It's just like they want the government to take your money.
But
I know a lot of libertarian anarchists, myself included, that do give to charities and do give pretty freely of my money.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm like literally when I went grocery shopping this past week, I had I think a budget of $50 to eat on for 2 weeks. So I bought 16 pounds of pork roast to last me 2 weeks.
You found it on sale. It was 99 cents a pound.
Yes.
You just can't pass up meat like that.
And so that was all of my food for 2 weeks. How did I start off? I gave Mike 2 pounds of meat that he could have a good roast.
Oh, and we made a hell of a roast. Yeah. That was a damn good roast.
Yeah. I mean, it's like...
Carrots were really good. They were like the star of that roast after the meat.
Yeah.
I made a semi-pabil.
A semi-pabil. Yeah, we'll have to... We're going to do a show on cooking one day.
You know, we have this
we're
other...
We're going to give recipes and talk techniques and everything.
We keep supposed to start this show Nutrition Punk, but we haven't done it yet.
It's hard enough to record this one show as it is.
What if we just alternate?
Every day I'm like, hey, Mike, we need to go record. No response. Hours later, look at this funny picture, James. You fucking jackass! What about recording? Shit and balls and hell and,
I'm a popular motherfucker. I have 3 kids and a wife that all want my attention.
Meow.
Plus, there's Netflix.
Yeah, where?
Hey, just being keeping it real, yo. I'm all about keeping it real and being myself.
Keeping it real. Ah, next article.
To those of you that got the irony of that statement, drop us a line.
Oh my god, I love Dave Chappelle's Keeping It Real segment.
Oh my god.
Ruin your life keeping it real.
Alright, but now we're talking about a guy who gets intruded by some people. He kills a burglar, a resident who shot, killed, and killed a burglar, and now is charged with voluntary manslaughter. Isn't that some bullshit right there?
This comes from KFOR.com.
Some very Wisconsin nice.
Whatever news channel for K4. Kiefer, that's Wisconsin-y.
Yeah, that's Wisconsin.
Akron, Ohio.
Oh, you would start.
An Ohio man is facing charges for allegedly shooting and killing an intruder who broke into his home. I don't see anything wrong with that. According to WJW, 25-year-old Marcus Glover and 37-year-old Terry Tart. Is he a comic book villain?
Terry Tart. Really, sounds like a British comic book villain.
I know. Allegedly forced their way into the home on Hilbish Avenue on August 7th.
I love the way they throw allegedly in there.
I know, allegedly. Once inside, they threatened the resident, 21-year-old David Hillis. Hillis lives on Hilbish. You weirdo.
So you're going to remember that way.
However, authorities say Hillis was armed. Authorities say he was armed. Did he just... Anyway. I'm just going to shoot you with my fingers. Ba-bow, ba-bow, pew-pew. Hillis was armed and fired shots at the pair, who tried to run. Glover was killed, but Tart managed to escape. Hillis was arrested and charged with involuntary manslaughter in the case. See a mistake? Report a typo here.
That's not part of it.
That is the end of that article.
Wow, that was a short one.
So apparently,
but we can vamp
apparently you can
on it
be
from...
dumb to work at K4.
Well, you see, there's certain states of this country have a law that's been nicknamed the He Needed Killing Law. It's basically where it's legal to shoot somebody who comes into your home or in self-defense. It's perfectly legal if your life
Castle
is threatened.
Doctrine.
Whatever.
Yeah.
I just know it by its nickname, the He Needed Killing Law. That's what they call it down in Texas, don't you know?
Castle Doctrine, yes.
Okay, but anyway, apparently in Ohio, that's not the frickin' case. I mean, these people forced their way into this man's home, threatened him at gunpoint, and when he defended himself, his right to breathe the frickin' free air that we're supposed to have in this country, he gets charged. These people were trying to kill me, and now I'm going to prison for it. Don't you know? That's bullshit.
Yeah. Ohio is generally pretty smart on these kinds of things. So I can only assume that if it even makes it to court, the jury will say, fuck off. And Will and Natalie, if you're on this jury, please drop this case, nullify it. I like jury nullification. I don't even see what DA would push charges on this guy.
Jesus Christ.
They made it sound like, and I don't know if this is the case, this is all I know about this case, they made it sound like they ran and he shot in the back, which a lot of people will have issues with. You try breaking into my house, I may shoot at you running away.
That's the thing. I wouldn't shoot a person in the back. I would shoot them in the leg until they turned around, and then I'd shoot them in the face.
Yeah. You'd definitely go to jail. I don't know. I don't see this guy committed a crime. They broke into his house. He shot them. I don't know all the details because this article was very
non-detailic,
and I don't know.
I'm all about inventing words these days.
Yep. So,
but you know what? I want our listeners out there to drop some lines in our comment section.
If you want Mike to never do this accent again, please drop me a line.
Well, fuck you.
Jeff
Radke brought this on himself, don't you know?
Yeah.
These guys out there thinking I'm all a girl with a southern accent.
Yeah, I'm done with this accent already.
Well, I'm not done with this accent. I made myself a promise.
I'm gonna do the rest of the show like this then. If Jimmy cracked corn and a nobody a cow, then why did he keep on doing it?
Yeah, but that's the only thing you could say of that accent. Every time you ever use that accent, that's literally the only thing you say.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
Yep, see, you're done.
Yep.
Use guys.
If Mike sucked balls and nobody cared, then why did he keep on doing it?
Mike didn't suck balls.
Yeah, he did.
Mike couldn't suck balls. Jeff was in the way.
Oh, I never told you about this comment on the blog that someone left that you would hate, actually.
Oh, what the fuck?
It's like, catch me too, Mike got a tick on him. That's the only... If Catch Material Mike got a tick on his dick, that's the only way he'd get sucked off. I'm like, it was something.
Who the fuck said that? Who the fuck? I'm gonna fuck this accent for a minute. I want to know who the hell said that.
Some guy. It was a fake nickname. It was like The One.
Oh, The One?
Yeah.
Yeah, you're about to get fucking Jack Johnson and Tim O'Leary right upside your fucking head.
Yeah.
Come on, show your real fucking name, you piece of shit.
Yeah.
Trust me, I've got my dick sucked more times than you ever had. Most of those were by your mother, by the way, so fuck off.
I was like, I think Mrs. Potato would disagree with that. Mrs. Potato. Mrs. Potato. Yeah, I've changed producer Mike's wife to Mrs. Potato.
Oh, he's probably some sad, pathetic little bastard living in his parents' basement. All he's got to do is bitch
about fried chicken.
Insult people on a podcast he ain't even paying for. Cocksucker.
Yes. Oh, wait. Never mind, we'll talk about it at the
Except
end.
When, you know, your sister sucks it. Then your mom doesn't have a chance. But usually when your sister's sucking my dick, that's usually when your mom is giving me the rim job, you know?
And on that bombshell, let's talk about... And I've read about this family before. So the article comes from SmithsonianMag.com. For 40 years, this Russian family was cut off from all human contact, unaware of World War II. In 1978, Soviet geologists prospecting in the wilds of Siberia discovered a family of six lost in the taiga. Taiga! Siberian summers don't last long. The snows linger into May. The cold weather returns again during September, freezing the taiga into a still life awesome in its desolation. Endless miles of straggly pine and birch forest scattered with the sleeping bears and hungry wolves. Steep-sided mountains, whitewater rivers that pour in torrents through the valleys, 100,000 icy bogs. This forest is the last and greatest of Earth's wilderness. It stretches from the furthest tip of the Russian Arctic region as far south as Mongolia, and is east from the Urals. It sounds like they're talking about Middle Earth here.
Really
Mongolia
does.
And the Urals to the Fire Mountain. to the Pacific. Holy shit, that's a giant fucking 5 million square miles of nothingness. With a population outside a handful of towns that amounts only to a few thousand people. 5 million square miles and a few thousand people.
When the warm days do arrive, though, the taiga blooms, and for a few short months it can seem almost welcoming. It is then that man can see most clearly into the hidden world, not on land, for taiga can swallow whole armies of explorers, but from the air. Siberia is, of course, the source of most of Russia's oil and mineral resources, and over the years, even its most distant parts have been overflown by oil prospectors and surveyors on their way to the backwood camps where the work of extracting wealth is carried on.
Thus, it was in the remote south of the forest in the summer of 1978, a helicopter sent to find a safe spot to land, a party of geologists, was skimming the tree line 100 or so miles from the Mongolian border when it dropped into the thickly wooded valley of the unnamed tributary of the Abakan. Is this Klingon? A seething ribbon of water rushing through the dangerous terrain. The valley walls were narrow, with sides that were close to vertical in places, and the skinny pine and birch trees swaying in the rotor's downdraft were so thickly clustered that there was no chance of finding a spot to set the aircraft down. But, that's my cat going crazy from eating catnip all morning, but peering intently through the windscreen in the search of the landing place, the pilot saw something that should not have been there. It was a clearing. 6,000 feet in the mountainside, wedged between the pine and the larch and scorched with what looked like long, dark furrows. The baffled helicopter crew made several passes before reluctantly concluding that this was evidence of human habitation. A garden that, from the size and shape of the clearing, must have been there a long time.
It was an astounding discovery. The mountain was more than 150 miles from the nearest settlement, in a spot that had never been explored. The Soviet authorities had no records of anyone living in the district. The four scientists sent to the district to prospect for iron ore were told about the pilot's sighting and were perplexed and worried them. "It's less dangerous," the writer Vasily Peskov notes in this part of the taiga, "to run across wild animals than a stranger." And rather than wait at their own temporary base, 10 miles away, the scientists decided to investigate. Led by a geologist named Galina Pisminskaya, they chose a fine day and put gifts in our packs for our prospective friends. "Though, just to be sure," she recalled, "I did check the pistol that hung at my side." As the intruders scrambled up the mountain, heading toward the spot pinpointed by their pilots, they began to come across signs of human activity. A rough path, a staff, a log laid across a stream, and finally, a small shed filled with birch bark, containers of cut up dried potatoes. Then, Pisminskaya said,
"Beside a stream, there was a dwelling, blackened by time and rain. The hut was piled up on all sides with taiga rubbish, bark and poles and planks. If I hadn't been for a window the size of my backpack pocket, it would have been hard to believe that people lived there. But they did. No doubt about it. Our arrival had been noticed, as we could see." The low door creaked, and the figure of a very old man emerged into the light of the day. Straight out of a fairy tale, barefoot, wearing a patched and repatched shirt made of sacking. He wore trousers of the same material, also in patches, and had a very uncombed beard. His hair was disheveled, and he looked frightened and was very attentive. We had to say something, so I began, "Greetings, grandfather. We've come to visit." The old man did not apply immediately. Finally, we heard a soft, uncertain voice, "Well, since you've traveled this far, you might as well come in."
The sight that greeted the geologist as they entered the cabin was something like from the Middle Ages. Jerry built from whatever materials he came to hand, the dwelling was not much more than a burrow, a low, soot-blackened log kennel that was as cold as a cellar, with a floor consisting of potato peel and pine nutshells. Looking around in the dim light, the visitors saw that it consisted of a single room. It was cramped, musty, and indescribably filthy, propped up by sagging joists and astonishingly home to a family of five. The silence was suddenly broken by the sobs and lamentations. Only then did we see the silhouettes of the two women. One was in hysteria praying, "This is for our sins." The other, keeping behind a post, sank slowly to the floor. The light from the little window fell on her wide, terrified eyes, and we realized that we had to get out of there as quickly as possible.
Led by Pesminskia, the scientists backed hurriedly out of the hut and retreated to a spot a few yards away, where they took out some provisions and began to eat. After about a half hour, the door of the cabin creaked open, and the old man and his two daughters emerged, no longer hysterical and, though still obviously frightened, frankly curious. Warily, the three strange figures approached and sat down with their visitors, rejecting everything that their eyes offered. Jam, tea, bread, where they muttered, "We are not allowed to eat that." When Pesminskia asked, "Have you ever eaten bread?" the old man answered, "I have, but they have not. They have never seen it." At least he was intelligible. The daughter spoke a language distorted by a lifetime of isolation. When the sisters talked to each other, it sounded like a slow, blurred cooing. Slowly, over several visits, the full story of the family emerged. The old man's name was Karp Lykov, and he was an old believer, a member of the fundamentalist Russian Orthodox sect, worshipping in a style unchanged since the 17th century. Old believers had been persecuted since the days of Peter the Great, and Lykov talked about it as though it had happened only yesterday. For him, Peter was a personal enemy and the Antichrist in human form, a point he insisted had been amply proved by Tsar's campaign to modernize Russia by forcibly chopping off the beards of Christians. But these centuries old, or beard and a head are the same thing, really. But these centuries old hatreds had conflated with a more recent grievance. Karp was prone to complain in the same breath about a merchant who had refused to make a gift of 26 poods of potatoes to the old believers sometime around 1900.
Things had only got worse for the Lykov family when the atheist Bolsheviks took power. Under the Soviets, isolated old believer communities that had fled to Siberia to escape persecution began to retreat even further from civilization. During the purges of the 1930s, and with Christianity itself under assault, a communist patrol had shot Lykov's brother on the outskirts of their village while Lykov knelt working beside him. He had responded by scooping up his family and bolting into the forest. That was in 1936, and there were only four Lykovs then. Karp, his wife, Akulina, a son named Savin, 9 years old, and Natalia, a daughter who was only two. Taking their possessions and some seeds, they had retreated even deeper into the taiga, building themselves a succession of crude dwelling places until at last they had fetched up in this desolate spot. Two more children had been born in the wild, Dmitri in 1940 and Agafia in 1943, and neither of the youngest Lykov children had ever seen a human being who was not a member of their family. All that Agafia and Dmitri knew of the outside world, they learned entirely from their parents' stories. The family's principal entertainment, the Russian journalist Vasily Peskov noted, was for everyone to recount their dreams. The Lykov children knew that there were places called cities and humans lived crammed together in tall buildings. They had heard there were countries other than Russia, but such concepts were no more than abstractions to them. Their only reading matter was prayer books and an ancient family Bible. Akulina had used the Gospels to teach her children to read and write, using sharpened birch sticks dipped in honeysuckle juice as pens and ink. When Agafia was shown pictures of a horse, she recognized it from her mother's Bible stories. "Look, Papa," she exclaimed, "a steed."
But if the family's isolation was hard to grasp, the unmitigated harshness of their lives was not. Traveling to the Lykov homestead on foot was astonishingly arduous. Even with the help of a boat along the Abakan, on his first visit to the Lykovs, Peskov, who would appoint himself the family's chief chronicler, noted that we traversed 250 kilometers without seeing a single human dwelling. Isolation made survival in the wilderness close to impossible. Dependent solely on their own resources, the Lykovs struggled to replace a few things they had brought with them into the taiga. They fashioned birch bark galoshes in place of shoes. Clothes were patched and repatched until they fell apart, then replaced with the hemp cloth grown from seed. Oh God, hemp cloth. If only it wasn't illegal. God, how'd they get away without smoking at all? The Lykovs had carried a crude spinning wheel and, incredibly, the components of a loom into the taiga with them. Moving these from place to place as they gradually went further into the wilderness must have required many long and arduous journeys. But they had no technology for replacing metal. A couple of kettles served them well for many years, but when rust finally overcame them, the only replacements they could fashion came from birch bark. God, the birch tree is like the Swiss family birch.
They fuck. It's yeah. Been their savior.
Since they could not be replaced, in fire, it became far harder to cook.
I can imagine.
By the time the Lykovs were discovered, their staple diet was potato patties mixed with ground rye and hemp seed.
Oh my God. In some respects, Peskov made clear the taiga did offer some abundances. Beside the dwelling ran a clear, cold stream. Stands of large spruce, pine, and birch yielded all that anyone could take. Bilberries and raspberries were close to hand, firewood as well, and pine nuts fell right on the roof. Yet the Lykovs lived permanently on the edge of famine. It was not until the 1950s, when the Dmitri reached manhood, that they first trapped animals for their meat and skins. Lacking guns and even bows, they could hunt only by digging traps or pursuing prey across the mountains until the animals collapsed from exhaustion.
Yeah.
Running in the damn things to death.
Which is the way our ancestors, the cavemen and whatnot, did it.
Dmitri built up astonishing endurance and could hunt barefoot in winter, sometimes returning to the hut after several days, having slept in the open in 40 degrees of frost and young elk across his shoulders. More often than not, though, there was no meat, and their diet gradually became more monotonous. Wild animals destroyed their crop of carrots, and Agafia recalled the late 50s as the hungry years. We ate rowanberry leaf, she said.
Roots, grass, mushrooms, potato tops, and bark. We were hungry all the time. Every year we held a council. Every year we held a council to decide whether to eat everything up or leave some for seed. Oh my God!
That is a hell of a decision.
That is, famine was an ever-present danger in these circumstances. And in 1961, it snowed in June. Oh my God, it snowed in June! The hard frost killed everything growing in the garden. And by spring, the family had been reduced to eating shoes and bark.
Oh my God.
Akulina chose to see her children fed, and that year she died of starvation.
Oh wow.
The rest of the family were saved by what they regarded as a miracle. A single grain of rye sprouted in their pea patch. The Lykovs put up a fence around the chute and guarded it zealously night and day to keep off mice and squirrels. At harvest time, the solitary spike yielded 18 grains. From this, they painstakingly rebuilt their rye crop.
Damn. As the Soviet geologists got to know the Lykov family, they realized that they had underestimated their abilities and intelligence. Each family member had a distinct personality. Old Karp was usually delighted by the latest innovations and the scientists brought from their camp. And though he steadfastly refused to believe that man had set foot on the moon, he adapted swiftly to the idea of satellites. And Lykov had noticed them as early as the 1950s when the stars began to go quickly across the sky. And Karp himself conceived a theory to explain this. People have thought something up and are sending out fires that they are very like stars.
Wow. That's, yeah, what a smart man.
what amazed him most of all, Peskov recorded, was a transparent cellophane package. Lord, what have they thought up? It is glass, but it crumples. And Karp held grimly to his status as head of the family, though he was well into his 80s. His eldest child, Savin, dealt with this by casting himself as the family's unbending arbiter in matters of religion. He was strong of faith, but a harsh man, his own father said of him, and Karp seems to have worried about what would happen to his family after he died if Savin took control. Certainly the eldest son would have encountered little resistance from Natalia, who always struggled to replace her mother as cook, seamstress, and nurse.
The two younger children, on the other hand, were more approachable and more open to change and innovation. Fanaticism was not terribly marked in Agafia, Peskov said, and in time he came to realize that the youngest of the Lykovs had more sense of irony that could poke fun of herself. Agafia's unusual speech, she had a sing-song voice and stretched simple words into polysyllables, convinced some of her visitors she was slow-witted. In fact, she was markedly intelligent. She took charge of difficult tasks in a family that possessed no counters of keeping track of time. She thought nothing of hard work, either, excavating a new cellar by hand late in the fall and working on by moonlight when the sun had set. Asked by an astonished Peskov whether she was frightened to be alone in the wilderness after dark, she replied, "What would be there out? What would be out there to hurt me?" Of all the Lykovs, though, the geologist's favorite was Dmitri, a consummate outdoorsman who knew all of the Taiga's moods. He was the most curious and perhaps the most forward-looking member of the family. It was he who built the family stove and all the birch bark buckets they used to store food. It was Dmitri who spent days hand-cutting and hand-planing. How was he planing? Each log that the Lykovs felled. Perhaps it was no surprise that he was also the most enraptured by the scientist's technology. Once relationships had improved to the point that the Lykovs could be persuaded to visit the Soviets' camp downstream, he spent many happy hours in a little sawmill, marveling at how easily a circular saw and lathes could finish wood. "It's not hard to figure," Peskov wrote. "That log that took Dmitri a day or two to plane and transform into a handsome even board before his eyes." Dmitri felt the boards with his palm and said, "Fine."
Karp Lykov fought a long and losing battle with himself to keep all of this modernity at bay. When they first got to know the geologist, the family would accept only a single gift, salt. Living without it for 4 decades, Karp said, had been true torture. Over time, however, they began to take more. They welcomed the assistance of their special friends among the geologists, a driller named Yurofe Sedov, who spent much of his spare time helping them plant and harvest crops. They took knives, forks, handles, grains, and eventually even pen and paper and an electric torch. Most of these innovations were only grudgingly acknowledged, but the sin of television, which they encountered at the geology camp, proved irresistible for them. On their rare appearances, they would invariably sit down and watch. Karp sat directly in front of the screen. Agafia watched poking her head from behind a door. She tried to pray away for her transgression immediately, whispering, crossing herself. The old man prayed afterwards, diligently and in one fell swoop. Perhaps the saddest aspects of the Lykov strange story was the rapidity with which the family went into the decline after they reestablished contact with the outside world. In the fall of 1981, 3 of the 4 children followed their mother to the grave within a few days of one another. According to Peskov, their deaths were not, as might have been expected, the result of exposure to diseases to which they had no immunity. Both Savin and Natalia suffered from kidney failure, most likely a result of their harsh diet, but Dmitri died of pneumonia, which might have begun as an infection he acquired from his new friends. His death shook the geologist, who tried desperately to save him. They offered to call in a helicopter and have him evacuated to a hospital, but Dmitri, in extremis, would abandon neither his family nor religion he had practiced all his life. "We are not allowed that," he whispered just before he died. "A man lives for howsoever God grants.
When all three Lykovs had been buried, the geologists attempted to talk Karp and Agafia into leaving the force and returning to be with relatives who had survived the persecutions of the purge years and who still lived on in the same old villages. But neither of the survivors would hear of it. They rebuilt their old cabin, but stayed close to their old home. Karp Lykov died in his sleep on February 16th, 1988, 27 years to the day after his wife,
Akulina.
Agafia buried him on the mountain slopes with the help of the geologists, then turned and headed back to her home. The Lord would provide, and she would stay, she said, and indeed she has. A quarter of a century later, now in her 70s herself, this child of the taiga lives on alone, high above the Abakan. She will not leave, but we must leave her, seen through the eyes of Yefori on the day of her father's funeral.
I looked back to wave at Agafia. She was standing by the river break like a statue. She wasn't crying. She nodded, "Go on, go on." We went another kilometer, and I looked back. She was still standing there.
I've read that story maybe several times at this point, and it still gets me every time I've read it. It's an amazing story of survival.
I mean, they
40 years.
I mean, they had to rebuild their wheat crop from a single sprout.
Yeah.
Guarded it day and night. They got 18 grains off of it and just replanted, I'm guessing, and just kept going.
I mean, it really shows you the spirit of humanity to survive, to keep on going.
It does. That's insanity.
Yeah. I mean, a couple things from that. Dimitri that built up, I mean, just from
him.
He was never a part of modern society. He was born into the wilderness, lived on a primitive diet he never consumed bread his entire life.
Wow.
And with that, yeah, people, there are vegans out there, you gotta eat your bread. With that, he was able to like chase down elk and from exhaustion and kill it and then carry it back.
That is like an ultimate paleo diet.
Yeah.
They lived on.
Yeah. I mean, they ate rye, but I'm sure, I mean, it was an ancient variety of rye, that they just mashed up. It wasn't even highly processed.
No, I mean, they had no way of processing things out there.
They couldn't bake anything. They had a primitive stove. They didn't have any cookware probably by the time Dimitri was born.
Think about it now out there, and I don't know how old this article is, but at the time of this article, it was just the last member of that family.
Yeah.
Out there alone in her 70s, still surviving.
Yeah.
Refusing all. Only thing they liked was the TV. I like that.
Yeah.
You got to admit, television, that's just one of those freaking things.
Yeah.
I mean, as soon as they introduced it, everybody who had ever seen or heard of it wanted one.
Yeah.
So it just makes sense.
One of the things that's thrown about in the survival community a lot is, you know, you can't survive on your own. You just can't go into the wilderness and survive. Like, you're an idiot to bug out to the wilderness and survive. There is truth in that. You're better off in a town, in a community, in a tribe, in a small, you know, community. But there are rare examples in history.
Not everyone can do it.
Not everyone can do it. Humans are fucking resilient.
It's like the doctor always says. We're survivors.
We are.
We've survived. I mean, hell, dude, life on this planet has survived no less than 10 extinction-level events. We're still fucking here.
Yeah. I still want to go into that at some point. The big extinction-level events that throughout history where mankind dwindled down and then came back from it.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think is an important part.
Look at the Black Death that wiped out God. The majority of life in the population of Europe.
And China.
Yeah.
You know how hard of a China hit was? And I think I saw evidence that the plague had hit, like, South America.
But we're still standing.
We're still standing.
We're more people on Earth than there ever has been.
Yeah.
Now our biggest enemy is ourselves.
Yeah.
Honestly, if we just got to survive ourselves.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I mean, that's just freaking remarkable right there.
It was shared, someone shared it on the Survival Punk fan page on Facebook, and it wasn't new to me. I had read this story, this exact, actually, story, a couple times before, but I thought you guys could kick out of it. I know Mike had never heard of this family before, and, they're fucking remarkable. There's a, it's somewhere in South America. I can't remember the exact place, and I didn't look it up for this show because I just thought about it right now. But there's a place somewhere in South America where I think a 25-mile area has been sanctioned off.
Off of this one dude!
Off this one dude. Just like Star Trek's, what is it, the first contact, the first thing? What is their rule they have? The Prime Directive.
Uh-huh.
They literally employed the Prime Directive on this guy.
Uh-huh.
So.
Yeah, I heard about this guy. I've read about him.
Yeah, he's the last member of a tribe that has, like, no contact with modern world. He's completely primitive. And there's a couple of times where scientists have, like, tried to make contact with him, and he killed one. Like, he shot with an arrow and killed it and freaking out because he didn't know what the fuck this guy was. His parents may have been alive, so he may have seen other people in his life.
Mm-hmm.
But either they died through disease or they were killed by another tribe, and he's...
I think it was a war between the tribes that drove him into the fucking jungle.
Yeah. And he's by himself, probably doesn't even have a language, because from what I heard, he died as a... I mean, his family tribe died as a young child.
Why would you need language if you had no one to talk to?
Exactly. I mean, I'm sure he makes something. I'm sure he... I mean, it's... Okay.
That just reminds me of these two Native Americans. There's this one language, Native American language. Only two people speak it, and they have refused to talk to each other for the last 20 years. they hate each other.
Wow.
They have nothing to say, so it's a language that's pretty much dead.
Wow. I think there's a lot of lessons we learned from these people, and just, I think the bigger message from them is just, we're fucking resilient. I mean, it can be done. Sometimes when you hear what someone else does, you think, well, I can't do that. I can't. But what I always think is what one man does, another man can do.
Yeah.
I mean, no one thought that the 4-minute mile could be achieved.
Now it's nothing.
Now it's kind of, yeah. I mean, it's...
I mean, people break that constantly.
Yeah. I mean, people in high school are breaking that. Like, it's not untold. I mean, I think my personal best ever was 9. But,
dude, I remember, I shit you not, in 4th fucking grade, we had one kid that fucking ran a mile in my class, and what was it, like 3 minutes and 52 seconds?
No, there you go.
I mean, think about it. 4th grade, that would have made him, what, 11, 10, 11, something like that? And he could break the 4-minute mile.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's... What a revolution. Like,
motherfucker.
Before, I remember that. I think the 1962 Olympics, when people did the, is it the pole vault? No, the high jump. People would jump over it forward. Like, they would jump and spread their legs over it.
Yeah. Dive
until,
over it.
Until, Farnsby?
Don't ask me, I have
no idea. Yeah. It's, he went to like the 1962 Olympics, and he jumped over backwards, and everyone was like, oh, you're a dumb fuck, but...
He got more what?
He won the gold medal.
Yeah.
With his Farnsberry flop, or whatever he called it.
Mm-hmm. And the way you mean...
And
the
now
way
that's
people,
the way that it's done.
I mean, there's technically no rule of how you can... The whole fucking thing, you jump over the damn thing however you can.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that's the way that works the best.
Yeah.
I've seen in, like, the Special Olympics, handicapped and mentally disabled people. I've seen a one-legged bitch get real fucking good air jumping that way.
Yeah. Wow.
I mean, I don't know if she's a bitch or not. But,
you know. Yeah, it's... You probably piss off everyone in the audience. They're like, you can't talk about them that way!
Women don't listen to this show outside of Scotland.
I have not really heard from any female listeners. Normally they just yell at me for having bad grammar on the website, and I tell them to suck it. I don't have time for your grammar Nazism, which I believe is a mental disorder. That's why I know.
You used to fucking do it all the time to my wife on Facebook.
She's just being a jackass.
Asshole.
Yeah, I wasn't being serious. She's being a jackass. Although sometimes your wife does, it's not even like close enough to English, so I'm like, I have no idea. You're like, I remember one time you and me were at the grocery store with a grocery list your wife read, and we're like, we don't know what the fuck half this shit is. What was it like? She wrote cottage cheese, but something. What was it? It was like goat head cake. Something. It was so. It was like.
In her defense, she is dyslexic, dude.
She graduated what, fourth in her class?
15th in her class.
15th in her class.
With dyslexia.
Yeah.
It's an indictment of the Dixon school system, and she'll even say that. But still. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, true survival, my friends, true survival. Which kind of leads me into, like, I think next week, and I need to give you a primer before we get into it, I want to have a show on bushcraft. If you listen to the show, you have anything on bushcraft that you want to talk about?
Oh, I've heard of that. They call it vajazzling.
No, they don't.
Oh, wait, different bush, never mind.
Bushcraft, no. Here in the United States, usually it's apparently being called woodcraft, but bushcraft is the British term that everyone knows. It's a British thing. You should get into it.
Yeah, I like British
things. You do like British things, yeah.
Most British things.
So yeah, if you have anything that you want us to talk about, send me an email, jamesrawpunk.com. Let's wrap this pig up.
Next week.
No, Primal Mayo!
Yeah, we're gonna be reviewing the Primal Mayo. This week's survival thingy that we almost forgot about. Yes, and you have to forgive me. I was screwing with Jordan with the laser pointer.
I saw that. Well, by wrap it up, I didn't mean move on out of that segment. So, and maybe I should sign up for an affiliate link so I can put it into the show notes so you guys click on it and I can make 3.5 pennies. Because I like making 3.5 pennies. So, there's this thing called the Thrive Market. It's a online market where you get sort of wholesale prices for high quality organic, a lot of it's paleo, some of it's not, goods that is cheaper. Like, for a lot of people, like, so the closest organic store that we can get to would be Whole Foods Market, and that's an hour and 20 minutes away.
Yeah.
An hour or something, hour 15, hour 20.
Yeah.
Or we can go to Franklin, where you work at. That's, what, an hour and a half or something?
It's still about the same.
About the same, yeah.
So I've been to the Whole Foods out there.
So for a lot of people, getting the high-quality food like that is just not an option in their area. You can grow some, but even still then, you know, you can't grow everything. You can't guard your rye grass 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Unless you have a whole family do it. So for those people, like, there's a lot of things like I like to have, and I can only get them from like Whole Food Market. Like, I like tamari, which is gluten-free organic soy sauce.
Okay.
You know, I go through like a bottle a year or so though.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, and I could have coconut aminos, which I could also get coconut aminos. They're sort of like soy sauce, but instead of made from soy, they're made from like coconut. Blah blah blah. I could also get that from like Whole Foods Market. I could also, if I went to the Whole Foods Market, get Mark Sisson's Primal Kitchen Mayo. Real mayonnaise made with avocado oil instead of olive oil. I like mayonnaise. I believe mayonnaise can be a health food. Focus on the show. Stop.
I'm watching you. I'm not even looking at the cat.
I believe that mayonnaise can really be a health food, but if you... One of the reasons why I don't really have mayonnaise in my refrigerator often is because of the ingredients. Put in the back of a jar of mayo, usually the first ingredient is like either high fructose corn syrup or soybean oil.
It's only supposed to be oil and eggs.
Yes.
That's it.
Oil, egg, salt, lemon juice.
Yeah, just oil and egg is the primary ingredients and then, you know, your flavoring. High fructose corn syrup's not supposed to enter the goddamn equation, ever.
People that like fucking... On this show, we eat mayonnaise. If you eat Miracle Whip, you're fucking wrong. You're fucking wrong, you jackasses.
Yeah, you're completely fucking wrong.
Yeah. That's one of the things that me and Mike agree on food, is Miracle Whip is wrong. wrong, wrong, wrong.
Yeah, the salad dressing form of mayo is, yeah, no, it's not supposed to be fucking sweet.
Yeah, so, I got a deal from Thrive Market. Like, Mark Sisson sent out an email on his newsletter that was like, hey, sign up for the Thrive Market for, I guess, free for a trial. So I'm going to cancel it. Unless I can. I mean, I want to say it's like $49 a year. Then you get like, so the deal was to get one of these jars of mayonnaise for free. Mm-hmm. You just had to pay shipping.
Okay.
Shipping from the Thrive Market was only $1.95 for 1 pound of a glass jar of mayo. But that's not bad at all.
No.
So $1.95, I got this, how much is this? 12 ounces. 12 fluid ounces. Few Australian does. 355 milliliters.
Like a vault.
355 milliliters. It is Primal and Paleo approved, which is the new branding label, because organic is a fucking racket from the government. Fuck that. Even though it probably is organic, they get away with not, they get away without having to pay the damn, pay Caesar his due.
Mm-hmm.
So it is Paleo and Primal approved with the Paleo approved stamp. It's like a, I guess you pay them to review your product and they say, yeah, it's Paleo approved.
Okay.
Sugar free. Yes. Soy and canola free. That's a lot of the stuff you get in stores have canola oil in it.
Right.
If I went to the store and the mayo said like olive oil, eggs, salt, lemon juice,
mm-hmm.
I'd buy that.
Yeah.
Soy and canola, dairy-free, gluten and grain-free, vinegar derived from beets. Interesting. So, what are the ingredients in the Primal Mayo? Avocado oil, organic cage-free eggs, organic egg yolks, organic vinegar, sea salt, and rosemary extract.
Yeah, it says organic all over the...
Yeah, I like that. You tried it. What were your thoughts on it?
It was good. It was a bit tangy.
It was a bit tangy. Because the vinegar.
Yeah. But not bad at all. Not bad at all.
I tried, so just like Mike tried it just sort of out of the jar, just a taste of it. I tried it out of the jar, just a taste of it. I personally felt the salt was a little heavy-handed. Which is weird because I love salt, but I thought the salt was a little heavy-handed, and the vinegar was a little heavy-handed, where it was,
Should try making some egg salad out of that.
You know what? I've been putting it in my scrambled eggs in the morning.
Oh, really?
Dude, it tastes good in there.
Well, you've been halfway there.
I've been halfway there. I was like, we should make some egg salad out of the Primal Mayo. That would be fucking tasty.
It's so weird how we think alike on some things.
Yeah. When I think of mayo, there's a couple of things I think of off the top of my head. So egg salad, tuna salad. I like to make a tuna salad occasionally.
Occasionally. I'm not a big tuna salad. I'm not a big tuna guy.
I do. I like it. I used to eat that at lunch because it was fairly cost effective and it's a good mix of protein and fat.
Yeah.
You put it over some salad greens. Apparently, I actually made a tuna salad that was a salad. And it freaked my ex-girlfriend off. Like, she was like, you make a tuna salad salad? I'm like, yeah. She's like, that's weird. You know? Oh, God damn it. So, Thrive Market, Primal Mayo, really good.
Yeah.
Mike has to take his kids to the movie. He's blowing me off. He wants to end this podcast.
I want to make my children happy. I promise them.
Yep.
You know, but don't make a promise to your kids that you don't intend on keeping. That's just, you don't keep promises to your children. That just makes them not trust you or have any respect for you later on. Like my mother.
Yeah. Let's wrap it up.
Alrighty then, Survival Punk Army wants you as always. You know how to get on that.
And speaking of that, I've actually changed my stance a little bit. I have some more people that sign up for the, so there are several options when you sign up with the Survival Punk Army. You can do it for a year for $50, which is good because I like that $50 whack at a time.
Right.
But I have an option where you can sign up to join the Survival Punk Army and you support this podcast, me and Mike, doing what we do when we do it, for $5 a month. Reoccurring payment. Nobody notices $5 a month.
No.
Nobody.
Not at all.
It comes out of your bank account and you don't notice it. I love that. I want to get as many $5 a month supporters as possible. It's just nice to have, like, that reoccurring monthly amount of money to buy Primal Mayo with. I need to have my Primal Mayo. So, you don't notice it. It helps keeping this the most electrifying survival podcast on the interwebs.
Yeah, that works.
I mean, really, I've had several emails from people saying, I've listened to some other survival podcasts.
The most electrifying podcast in survival entertainment.
Yes. We're like 1999 ECW of survival podcasts. Yeah, you got the big guys out there. The fucking WWFs and the WCW and the NWO.
But we're going to hit you with a fucking baseball bat wrapped in barbed wire.
And cut your fucking face open, you little pussies.
And on that bombshell.
And on that bombshell, don't be a pussy.
Yes.
Only listen to the most electrifying podcast on survival.
Yep.
Use guys,
yeah, we derailed.
Yeah.
And for the Survival Punk Podcast, this is Couch Potato Mike.
This is James Sicklin Burnett.
And Jeff, you know I love you.
DIY to keep your riot plants alive!
Use guys, don't you know?
Use guys!